Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Melissa Butcher, and I am the program director here at Cumberland Lodge. Welcome to everyone online to our dialogue and debate this month. And we're going to be focusing on civility, or perhaps more importantly, incivility in politics. And this theme is part of the work that we're doing on the Youth and Democracy Project in particular at the Cumberland Lodge at the moment. So we're joined by Hannah Phillips, a consultant with the Jo Cox Foundation, who has been working on producing the recently launched report of the Jo Cox Civility Commission. That report is titled No Place in Politics: Tackling Abuse and Intimidation. Hannah is also a former Cumberland Lodge Fellow and just joining us right in the nick of time. Thanks, Jess. We're also joined by Jess Phillips, Labour MP for Birmingham Yardley, who I think it's fair to say has received more than her fair share of abuse during her time in politics. Thank you both for joining us today. You're very welcome to Cumberland Lodge.
Hello, so sorry I was running out. My last meeting ran over wildly, which is what happens all the time, so.
Yeah, no, we assumed it was something like that, Jess. Thank you so much for joining us. In the past couple of weeks, I think it's fair to say we've seen the government some particular issues around this question of civility or incivility in politics. The government's had to commit an extra £31 million to increase security for MPs. We've have politicians and police struggling with new forms of protest that are including direct forms of confrontation near politicians' homes. We've heard language that's considered Islamophobic and anti-Semitic. So, Hannah, maybe to you first. Can you give us an overview of the nature and extent of the problem of abuse and intimidation in politics that you've found in your report?
Yes, absolutely. And first of all, just to say thank you so much for inviting me here. And also, Jess and I are not actually related, even though we have the same last name. But thank you to Jess and to the Lodge for highlighting this issue. One thing I would say is this isn't a new issue. I think there's been lots of focus in the last few weeks, but this the issue of an abuse, intimidation, harassment in politics is something that is not new in politics, but it does seem to have become worse in the last 10 or so years, and particularly the last few years. Another thing to emphasize is that this impacts those working in politics at all levels. And so it's not just MPs, but councillors, police and crime commissioners, members of devolved administrations, local councillors, parish councillors. And importantly, it's not just politicians who are impacted, but it's staff and families. So I think that's something that's important in this issue. And something that's really important is that abuse can impact, anyone who's working in politics, but it does, evidence suggests that there is this disproportionate impact on women, which is even more pronounced among those from minority ethnic backgrounds. So it's very appropriate that we're discussing this issue in the run-up to International Women's Day. And violence and abuse can take a range of forms. Melissa, you talked about kind of new forms of protest. Social media is a kind of newer form of this, but it's not just online abuse. And online abuse can be very related to offline abuse, as it were. There's intimidation in meetings, stalking and harassment. And of course, it's important to remember that two MPs have been murdered in the last 8 years, Jo Cox and Sir David Amess. And I think it's important to acknowledge for Jess and colleagues that Jo and David were colleagues. And I know for Jess, Jo was a very close friend. So I think that's important to recognize that this is a very, very important issue, and it has gone to the extreme of murder. And there are other forms that are more everyday. The online abuse is pretty regular. A lot of the people that we spoke to talked about that certain forms of abuse were now kind of expected and normalized. It's kind of normal for staff that now part of their job is to like go through social media and decide what they should report to the police. And that is just an expected part of being in politics. And we can, at the Jo Cox Foundation, we don't believe it should be an expected part of politics. And the final thing I'll say is the reason that we are so that we're working on this issue and think it's an important issue is not because of the way that Jo Cox died, but because of the way she lived. She was passionate about getting more women into politics, representative democracy. And this issue does threaten representative democracy. There's evidence that that current politicians are not speaking out in the way that they might because of kind of fear of abuse. And there is evidence that people are not stepping into politics because of abuse. And one of the kind of most shocking pieces of evidence that we found for our report was research by Girl Guiding UK that shows that the issue of online abuse is shaping the career choices of girls and young women, with more than a third put off from doing certain jobs, including politics, because of the abuse high profile women get online. And if there's not, no one, these girls go into careers and they're not entering politics, and people from diverse background are not entering politics, that will have a huge impact on our representative democracy, which is such an important part of our politics.
Great, thanks, Hannah. Just before we pick up on that point about the impact of this abuse with Jess, just a reminder to people who are listening online, please feel free to submit any questions that you have in the chat bar, and we'll come to those a bit later on in the dialogue. Jess, just over to you. You've been on the receiving end of much abuse, including, I believe, in the report, 600 rape threats via social media in one evening alone. How does that impact on you personally?
It's funny because I have to think of it in terms of then and now. The impact on me now has become so normalized as to be almost like most things, I have to say, in women's lives, a tolerable level of pain is expected. The way it made me feel when it was first happening was it was just really, really shocking. I wouldn't say I felt scared that any of it was going to come to fruition. The reality of it, I didn't believe was going to come to fruition. But I think in my case, they used the situation of rape, which common sexual violence is the way to go, with female politicians, or just females generally, but specifically because I speak so much about the issue of rape. And when people invoke the idea of rape and sexual violence to me, that isn't, it isn't theoretical. It is very, very, very real. And so, at first, it made me feel, well, I was just shocked. And to be perfectly honest, I was shocked to action initially. That was my main response, was to do something about it. The way I feel about it now, and I have to say, I found the last few weeks to be trying in this conversation about members of Parliament's safety, because I am no less safe currently than I ever have been. Now, that's because I live my life at a constant state of being at heightened risk. There won't be a year in my life where I'm not in a courtroom, having to put off my holiday plans, for example. I've just been given a court date for the 29th of July, and I was a bit like, oh man, what if I want to go on holiday? Luckily, not knowing when the election is means basically going on holiday is a no-no for me. The way me and my family have all completely got used to it now, and I don't micromanage things particularly, because things are systematically put around me well enough now that it has become a workable part of my working life. Now, that in the period in between those two instances, I am medicated for anxiety, and I literally sat with a psychiatrist, and I'm going to swear now, my grandfather used to basically say, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean the bastards aren't trying to get you. It like you can't really medicate for a trauma that you have suffered, an incidence of trauma and threat and violence, if that threat and violence is still in place. So I both have to try and deal with the traumas that I have suffered, the greatest amongst them, the most triggering trauma, of course, and in fact, tonight I'm going to have dinner with her children, is the murder of Jo Cox. That is a trauma I will never get over. I just have to learn to live with it in my life, like any trauma. But I have today, I forget. I mean, it's just tedious, is actually the way it manifests in my life. It's just tedious. I like it just means work, extra work, and especially when you're talking about women politicians suffering from it more. Women politicians are already doing loads of free labor, as women in society have to do in caring and various other things that women are just expected to do. I have to also do loads of free labor with the Justice Department. I have to go to court a lot. I have to spend hours. I can't tell you, if you've never given a police statement, how long it takes. It's absolutely ridiculous, seriously. Get with the program, the police. It takes hours. I once gave a police statement for 9.5 hours on the basis of the volume of abuse that one man had sent me. And it took 9.5 hours.
And that's just one, sorry, Jess, that
That
was just one
was
man.
one instance. He's in prison now. Like, actually what he was saying to me just felt like noise. Like, I'm like, it didn't upset me, it didn't scare me. But then in having to deal with it, like, I had to take an entire day out of work. And when you're sat there going through all the evidence and putting it all into files with the police officer in front of you, that's when it hits you. That's when it's like, oh my gosh, this is just so physically tiring on me, and time sapping on me. The only time I've ever thought I can't do this anymore, there's only been one occasion, not even after Joe being killed and then David Amos, was I went to an event with my son to see a children's author that he liked when he was about 10, 9 or 10, and it got crowded in the room that we were in because this person is famous, and we had been invited to go into this back room to meet him, and there were lots of people hubbubbing around, and I noticed that my son, who'd been very excited and is not an unconfident child, was standing with his back against the wall in this hubbub. And I was like, "Are you all right?" And he was just like, "Oh, I wanted to stand near the door in case we needed to escape." And like, I thought, if I keep my back against the wall, no one can hurt me from behind. And I just thought, that is because my children have had to become hyper alert. And I worked in women's refuges for many, many years. I've watched children who have to be hyper alert of danger and risk. And I realized that the sort of uncontrollable situation in the room for my son made him feel like he had to be, like, when a 9-year-old is looking for the exits, you've got a problem. And that's the only time I thought that that's it. I cannot do this anymore. And the moment when Westminster was attacked, my kids' school had to try and they had to keep the kids in school so that they couldn't switch on their phones until they'd found both my children, pulled them out, explained to them that I was okay, because my kids were just going to come out of there, everyone's going to turn on their phones, see that there's Westminster's been attacked. And for my kids, that would be harrowing. So the kids were kept in school. Like, that's the effect that you don't think about. Like, that's the work that has to go on around me and my family, is that people have to change their systems fundamentally. And, 1,500 children had to be locked in classrooms, not looking at their phones, in order that my children could try and live a semblance of a normal life. That's the problem.
And I think that's really something that comes out of the report, highlighting the fact that it's not just MPs that suffer from this, but it's families, it's staff members. There's a cascade effect to it as well. Jess, do you think the new package of measures that the government's just announced, is it going to be enough?
Well, I don't know really what the details of it are yet. What I would say is that it's nothing that I haven't had for years. So there's 10 of the there was classically during the Brexit debates, there was 10 of us identified, and post Joe's murder, and this is the problem. And as somebody who's worked in this line of work for a long time, is risk assessment is actually relatively pointless, because nobody would have risk assessed Joe, nobody would have risk assessed David Amos as being high risk, especially David Amos. Joe would have probably flagged up on a number of different metrics for being a possible risk, and that being that the most at risk members of Parliament, when they initially did that risk assessment, were all women, Labour women above the who represented above the M25, basically. Even though there were, like, the best example of the person who gets the most abuse is Diane Abbott, without a shadow of a doubt. Like, she gets way, way more abuse. But the actual risk of threatened violence that they perceived that abuse turning into was all, apart from there was one Tory woman, and that was Anna Soubry at the time. But that we were at risk of violence and threat. And within that, it was almost all of the Jewish women MPs at the time. And I imagine that that would remain the case if any of them were still members of Parliament. And we note that none of those three women on that list are still members of Parliament. And that is, that's not correlation, that is causation. And so at that point, we were all given I have been able to be driven around should I desire to be. I have close protection when I request it. The truth is, though, is members of parliament are our own worst nightmares in this light, because I don't request it. I don't want security. I don't want bomb-proof windows. I've got nice stained glass windows. And my husband was like, if we're at bomb level, they're just going to shoot you when we walk outside, so just keep the nice windows.
I see dark humor is one way of coping
Oh,
with it,
you've
Jess.
got to laugh at it. You've got to laugh. I mean, I worked, like I say, I've worked in rape crisis in human trafficking. I've seen terrible things, and I know that laughing about it and actually learning to live, it's all terrible. I don't want those societal ills but you have to have dark humor in order to cope with it. You have to.
Yeah. How did we get to this point? Maybe Hannah, you could come in here, and you mentioned social media, but is there something else that's going on in society? I mean, social media is just a conduit. Why is it that we have this kind of torrent of abuse and anger that's pouring forth onto elected politicians?
Yeah, it's an excellent question, and I think there are various reasons, and it's quite a complex issue. Like, so if MPs were being abused by one certain group, it might be a bit easier to be like, okay, it's like from like the far right white supremacists, we know we can focus on them, but it's from all over society. So I think that is something that makes it quite complex. I think so, as you say, social media is definitely a conduit. So I think something that we my colleagues at Jo Cox Foundation, I find interesting, is social media didn't come up as much as we perhaps were expecting when we talked to various stakeholders. Actually, what the thing that came up in almost every conversation was political literacy and people, the kind of a lack of understanding of what exactly elected representatives are supposed to do. And that is something that's a kind of longer term recommendation that we have to kind of really increase the level of kind of civic education. I think there are there's other bigger issues in terms of increasing the polarization, and we saw that with the two referendums we've had, the Scottish referendum and the Brexit referendum. And something that's interesting is that colleagues, particularly in Scotland and Wales, talk about how nationalism, no matter kind of what side of the issue you're on, but that is a very key issue for them kind of receiving abuse. And I think also importantly at the local level, a lot of the abuse that councillors get is around kind of planning decisions or pretty like hyper local controversial decisions. So I think there's lots of different reasons why this is happening, and I think I'm a PhD student, so I would any other academics out there would really encourage more research to really kind of understand some of the causes. But I guess the main takeaway is that it is quite a complex problem with lots of different causes.
It's political binary is part of the problem. So, whether that's down to education and understanding that even a binary isn't that binary. There have the incidences of political binary. The nationalist referendum, actually, we didn't pay anywhere near enough attention in the referendum in Scotland, because it happened in Scotland, and let's face it, if it had happened in Westminster, it would have been bigger news. Because it happened in Scotland, the binary that was created that then bred something political that we maybe hadn't seen so clearly before. Because even if you think about, like, the biggest binary prior to that would have been the Iraq war situation, and even that. Whilst I have no doubt that, I mean, in fact, it's not that I have no doubt, I know, like, so Stephen Timms was stabbed over the Iraq war by a woman who was very, very unwell, to be clear, like somebody who was very, I think it was a woman, but it was somebody who was very, very unwell. It did create political violence and hostility. But the lack of civility, it was presented, like, I marched against Iraq with my mum and dad. It was presented always, and I recently found the letters my mum had written to her member of parliament, who was also her next door neighbour. And it was presented as sorrow and civility. It wasn't this, So the incivility, the first instance of it came, I think, in the binary moment of the referendum, and we didn't mark it enough, and we didn't look into it. There wasn't research done into it enough for it to then really inform how we might do other binary decision making or referenda the same afterwards. And that, hindsight's a wonderful thing. That I think it was a massive failing. But the truth is, from my perspective, is that the deliciousness of the incivility, which all politicians will stand up and say that they hate, they don't hate it. It's delicious, and populism is delicious to politicians. So whilst, they sweat the binary very, 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 very often, and we hand-wring and say we don't want this and we don't want that, but at the same time we ourselves practice a wedge, 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 wedge. And even when things aren't a binary, because we have seen the way that binaries get dealt with, people try and create new binaries now in a way that they just didn't before. So when things are really nuanced and really complex, if you think of some of the equalities, like the trans debate, for example, or even the process protest versus legislating against protest, like these are big issues that need proper discussion, but it's politically expedient for the politicians to make them into a binary, because binaries grab attention, make headlines. So, I'm not saying I'm not, I've been raised to not blame the victim. I'm not saying that when that turns into violence that we shouldn't act and have all of the things in place and that we shouldn't talk about it. But I am saying there is a more fundamental issue about the idea of binary rather than nuance in our politics globally.
Can I take up on that point, actually, Jess? Because while Hannah, you mentioned political literacy, the report also talks about improving behaviour, getting politicians to stick to the Nolan principles, screening candidates better, for example. But is there something inherent in our system? We are predominantly a two-party system. We use first past the post. It's very adversarial. It's very much winner takes all. And I'm wondering if there's something also inherent in the way that we do politics with first past the post. That is also ratcheting up the tensions, and then the abuse and intimidation of politicians as well. I don't know, Jess, if you have thoughts on that or Hannah.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that you're right. We live essentially in a politically binary system, with a two-party state. Same in the US. Same, I mean, in most parts of the world, although there have been actually populism has led to third parties rising in, or the push against populism has led to, in France, for example, to a new political parties rising up. I understand that they don't have a first past the post system. I'm always really wary, especially at the moment, of thinking that somehow a more proportionally representative system would make better politics, because I give you Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, that they have, and actually there is quite a lot of evidence that fringe elements of radicalism flourish more in a system where you are going to rely on a smaller party for votes for your government to take the lead. I'm not saying either one system is better. I am saying that it's not, I don't think that just changing the way we vote will change this now cultural incivility.
Hannah, one of the troubling stats in the report was that 16% of 18 to 24-year-olds thought abusive behaviour was acceptable, compared to only 3% for those over 45. And this is actually a question that's also come in from the audience, that if young people were hoping to get into politics or become MPs, particularly if they're women, what we can do to encourage them to keep their hope. But I guess, first of all, this idea, there seems to be a shift in how young people think about or are thinking about abuse and intimidation. And I wondered what your findings were, if you could elaborate on those findings from the report.
Yes, absolutely. That research was actually carried out by the Electoral Commission Public Attitude Survey in 2023. They did a big survey in a lot of different areas in politics. But we thought that one was particularly interesting, because particularly like in the aftermath of the Brexit referendum, there has been this kind of, I guess, narrative that, okay, well, it's kind of uncivil now, but young people will come and it'll be like all kind of better and civil. And that's not necessarily true, in this point. So that other research, and I know Jess has been involved in conversations about this, points out that there's still kind of quite a lot of kind of misogyny in schools and attitudes, and there's research about attitudes towards gender equality are not as progressive as you might as expect amongst young people. So I guess from our point of view, I would come back to that political literacy and the kind of it's not just political literacy, but digital literacy. How do you conduct yourself online? How do you kind of, how do you conduct yourself online so you're not being abusive? What do you do when you are abused online? And when we, one of the organizations we worked with, Shout Out UK, they are the convener of the all party parliamentary group on political literacy, which Kim Leadbeater, Jo Cox's sister, is one of the chairs. And Shout Out asked us, they said to us, like, when you say political literacy, say digital literacy as well. Like, it's really important that kind of all of these different types of literacy and education are not taken, kind of separate. And I think probably would add to that something around kind of equalities or kind of understanding power relations and all of that. And that's more coming from my own kind of academic background, looking at gender and equality and kind of public life. But that kind of all of these kind of aspects really do interrelate. So I think, I guess in advice to young people, I know Jess will have more to say about this, but I think it's interesting because we're talking about how the kind of how challenging it can be and the problems when you're in politics, but also can be so impactful. And we need lots of people in politics. And it's very funny. I think a lot of the MPs and the councillors, other representatives that I've spoken to, from my academic work, but also with part of the foundation, they say like it's really hard. Abuses, become more and more. It's really polarized, but it's the best job in the world. So it's a really interesting. It's always interesting conversations, but I would say that kind of, I guess, like democracy needs more, again, a diverse range of people in politics.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this, the latter point is one that it's important to stress. I think it's also important to stress that I get way more fan mail than I get hate mail, and that doesn't get written about. I mean, I literally have to have special inboxes for the amount of fan mail that I get. And my office, if you could see it, like, it's surrounded in literally like love bombs. Yesterday at like 20 past 11, when I got back to the flat that I live in London, I went to the corner shop, and there was a sort of very tall, rowdy young man, must have been about 17, in the shop, and he was clearly mates with the young shop, and he was like, "Oh my God, you're Jess Phillips," and he described me as the goat, which I believe means the greatest of all time. He took a selfie with me. He's like, "I love your videos," like, and I was like, "I didn't know I had them. I didn't know I had these videos that you love, but apparently I do." And he was like, he was, I mean, he was almost aggressively pleasant to me. To an outsider, it may have seemed a bit overwhelming. Just to stress that, like, if you are a committed politician, especially if you are focused on really, really specifically on issues that really matter to you, and you can get that across passionately, which young people definitely feed off. I mean, clearly, this young man called Danny, he clearly felt it, that actually you get huge amounts of adoration and love. That is the first thing I want to say. But what I would say with regard to the age split is, there is definitely an age split in the incivility, and for me, it is under 40s and over 40s, that it's the difference is so marked. So if I, on the binary issue currently of the conflict in Gaza, between Israel and Gaza, and Hamas, if I knock on doors in an area in my constituency that are, are deeply, deeply invested in the plight of Palestinian people, the difference in tone of the conversation, if somebody is over the age of 40 and if they are under the age of 40. Now, it's not necessarily that they're being abusive to me if they're under the age of 40, but they are emotive in a way, And I think that a lot of this comes from the digital element that Hannah is talking about, is that they are sitting and watching TikTok videos of horror. I'm not even saying that it's misinformation. It isn't in lots of these cases, but that people are have so much access to the ills of the world now. Whereas, like when the Iraq war was happening, which I said, as I said, I marched against, I read a, you see it on the 6 o'clock news, and I read accounts of it in the newspapers of that were based on people's opinion. And actually, you knew that when you read something, that you had to see it through the lens of it being someone's opinion. If you scroll through TikTok or on Instagram Reels or whatever is your particular policy, like from one horrifying video of a child being murdered to the next horrifying video of a child being murdered to the next, it's no wonder then that somebody who you perceive, rightly or wrongly, as being in charge of that knocks on your door, that you might be like, emotional. So, like, and I'm not saying it's abusive. It is sometimes it's wrong. Sometimes what people say is wrong. I'm not saying I'm getting a harrowing amount of abuse, but I am getting the difference in the temperature of the conversation is marked between people who are under the age of 40 and over the age of 40, and that is because of both political literacy, critical thinking, and digital literacy. And so, actually, tackling those things is going to be really vitally important in like actually I want a bit I want that group to turn the volume up a bit, I like a bit of emotional volume. I'm the greatest of all time, and the only reason that fella knew me is because I use emotional power in my interventions as a politician. So you need, I'm not saying it should go away, but it has to be placed. It's at the moment, it feels so scattergun. People's emotions are so scattergun that it feels like it hits everyone and like, and misses the target. And that is problematic.
Following up on that, just one of the questions from a question from Joan is whether we're seeing the shift away from reasoned argument. So she say it's good to have some emotion perhaps in these arguments, but or in these debates, but without that critical thinking, without that reasoned argument, that's when it can sort of shoot off into more harmful directions.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the case. I think that critical thinking and critical thought, I mean, even just forcing everybody to like play the devil's advocate. Like my grandfather was, I mean, to say staunch socialist wouldn't cut it. But he used to read the Telegraph because he used to jokingly say, I want to know what my enemies, you got to know what the enemies are up to. And but that like I definitely remember in my childhood that even though I came from very, very politically one way family, that I was trained to assess the source material that I was reading, that I was seeing, and to take some of it with a pinch of salt. Now, of course, you always have confirmation bias, and you look, that's always, that's human nature. But the idea that like you can't be critical, you can't say, well, you would say that. So actually, the effort of making children take on the devil's advocate, and also young people's take on the devil's advocate argument, I think has been partially lost. Like contrarianism actually, and teaching that is no bad thing, to try and see things from other people's perspectives and have a sort of critical glaze over something. I would say is it feels lesser in my children than it was in and also the idea, and this is, and it's sort of equality's gone mad. God, I sound like I'm on GB News. The idea that everything is for everyone and so it should be, that's not true in my view. This idea that some people, that everybody's opinion matters equally, well, it just simply doesn't. Like to people who abuse me online about violence against women and girls, like they think that their opinion matters, that they have the same entitlement to an opinion as I do. However, they just simply, like, you don't get to tell women what their experiences are. You don't get to tell black people what their experiences are. Like this idea that everybody is equal, and has equal understanding is a rot, an absolute rot. I wouldn't do it to a doctor. I wouldn't say to a doctor, like, I've broken my arm, and the doctor says, you've broken your arm, and I'll be like, oh, you would say that. You would say that, but actually, I think I haven't broken my arm. Like, it's something else. And yet, that is the experience in this sort of idea that everybody's opinion, it, like, you know, should be listened to.
So we've
Rubbish.
got quite thanks, Jess. So we've got quite a few questions coming in, and maybe one going back to you, Hannah, from another Hannah, is if you could elaborate a bit more on the of how do we address the abuse and harassment of counsellors at the local level. So again, as you were saying, while we tend to focus more on what's happening at Westminster, there's other levels of abuse and intimidation which seem to have less protection, like local councillors.
Yes, absolutely. It's a really crucial point. We worked extensively with the Local Government Association and the National Association of Local Councils, and the LGA and NELC. They have the LGA has a Debate Not Hate project with lots of resources, and then the and NELC has a Civility and Respect project. So there is really great work happening on a local level, and we support the recommendations in those pieces of work. And some of the recommendations, for example, are that councils should pass motions affirming principles to address abuse and model good behaviour, having that kind of on the as a priority as part of the council. And we also believe that local authorities should secure that the security and well-being resources are available to councillors, that they're clearly signposted, that councillors know where to go. If they've experienced if they've experienced something, they have the security resources, but also that kind of well-being support. I think that's something that we try and emphasize in all parts of the report. And we also the other recommendation specifically for local authorities is improving that risk planning for abuse at council meetings, because that is something that came up with a lot of the councillors we spoke to, that it is council meetings that a lot of this a lot of these problems can arise, particularly when there's been a controversial planning issue or so on. And in the news this week, it's likely that a lot of local authorities are facing funding pressures, so that those type of issues can be really important and can lead to abuse at a local issue at a local level. Yes, but the main takeaway is to support kind of the experts. As Jess was alluding to, the experts in this issue, the Local Government Association and the National Association of Local Councils.
Thank you. One question that's come up a few times in the chat is, what do you think our chances are of a civil election campaign
Zero.
this year? Would you want to elaborate a bit on that, Jess?
Absolutely zero chance of a civil. I mean, we had a debate about the, well, in the International Women's Day debate, it was couched in terms of like language used against women politicians last week, and it was just a brilliant moment at the end where Caroline Noakes, who is a brilliant woman, not from my political tradition, but a brilliant woman, said she said, "Well, I intend to go into this election and not be racist, not to be sexist, not to be vile, and not to lie about opponents, and to be honest, it won't be hard." Like, that's the lowest of bars. Like that, but no. The election won't be civil for a number of reasons, and some of them should be able to be controlled. Some of them we have not come up with a manner of. So you always get sort of third party, seemingly external campaign lobby groups that are definitely linked to like either a local candidate or a political party. So in Brexit, we saw a huge amount of this on relatively all sides, like of just sort of like shadily not quite knowing. And one of the principles of political campaigning is if you say something, you have to say that you've said it. That's a basic principle. You literally have to write on the bottom of every leaflet that it was you who, you know, like this is Jess Phillips and this is the address. Obviously, it's not my real address, although it used to have to be. That's one of the things that had to change, and certainly was for councillors. I had to put my address on the ballot paper. Ridiculous. Like that bit needs considerably better control, and I have to say the Electoral Commission in this space just doesn't have the teeth that is necessary, or the resource, or you know, or the political will pushing it to do better in this particular space, I have to say. So I don't expect, but what I don't what I mean, we will have like the security minister standing up and talking about incivility. If you think that there aren't political parties at the moment who are delighted with the binary about, for example, the war in Israel Gaza, between Israel and Gaza, if you think that that isn't going to be sweated by whether it's clandestine or otherwise funding to independent candidates to stand in areas to squeeze votes, then I'm afraid to say you are living in a fantasy world. That the binary and the aggression that some people will face will absolutely be sweated by main political parties, and that's the thing that is unforgivable. That's the if the rhetoric from leaders of political movements in no way matches the way, and they don't get their own hands dirty with this, but it. Believe me, people's hands are dirty. It that and everybody's sorry when it goes badly wrong and someone gets killed. But the reality is that is absolutely that goes on. And whether it's direct or indirect, it is made fertile rather than actually planted by people. But all of those things have to be dealt with. Also, we've got the issue of fakery. Fakery is going to be, and whether, like when it happens to Keir Starmer and there was some fake video of him made slagging off Liverpool or whatever, and it sounded really real. And that is a real worry. But literally, all of like the Conservative, it was actually the Conservatives I saw spreading that it wasn't real, not that it was real. They were saying, no, this is wrong. This is like, don't spread this. This is shit. Like, don't do it. Like at that level, that happens. What happens to people like me is fake stuff is made. It isn't spread by, mainstream political parts of the movement. It's spread around on, unknown WhatsApp groups and this, that, and the other. And then people believe it to be the case, and then that causes attacks on me. So the sort of fakery that goes on. I mean, I had somebody come and speak to me once. I'm no defender of Benjamin Netanyahu, as I think I've made clear on this in my remarks. But they kept saying to me and said, "I've watched a video online of Benjamin Netanyahu beheading a Palestinian child." Now, I don't like the man. That isn't true. It just isn't true. And that there is bad faith actors. And some of them are state actors, like Russia, Iran. Like, we know that there are state actors causing this disinformation and fakery to go on. But it rocks up on my doorstep, not on Rishi Sunak's or Kiama's. It knocks up on my doorstep. And that's alarming. So no, I don't think there's, I mean, we'll all try and be civil. Maybe if it's quick. If we could just have it like in May and then just announce it like 3 weeks before, just make it really quick. Quick and dirty will be less dirty than before.
Can you give us a heads up, Jess? When's the goss? They're still not letting us know.
I think
It's
it'll
not.
be May.
You think it may? Wow. Okay. Great.
Melissa, can I just add something on it? Because Jess said we'll try. And if you go onto Jo Cox Foundation Twitter, you'll see we've got our civility pledge. And that's for candidates to sign. And of course it's a small action, a small recommendation, but it's designed to be one of many things that happen. And one other of our recommendations has actually been already implemented is that the government should make costs associated with candidate safety an exemption to election spending. So that is something that's happening. And another recommendation I should have mentioned in terms of local government is as part of that new funding announced by the government also included extending the police support, the Operation Bridger network, which is the local coordinated network of police officers that's currently only for MPs, extending that to councillors as well, and that is something that we
That's a
had
good
called
idea.
for. So we were, pleased about that. So a few kind of hopeful election, bits of progress.
And certainly the Jo Cox with the Jo Cox civility pledge, Hannah, how are you approaching politicians? Have many signed up to that yet?
I believe so. I should have
think most of them probably would.
I think most of it, most people have. The one specifically now is for the May local elections, and it will be for the national election too if that is announced. But we do, most politicians do, sign up for it, and
Trouble is if you
particularly.
sign it, you can't then call somebody who's standing in one of those elections in ad hoc to Islamists, for example. Just to pull an example out, that's not very civil, is it? Like, and that was directly because there is an election. It's just so horrible when there's an election. Elections. I mean, if only democracy wasn't the best of a bad system, elections should be banned. They're awful.
I should say one of the projects we're working here at Cumberland Lodge on youth and democracy is to work with young people to reimagine democracy for the 21st century. So please, if
Happy
people are
to.
interested in that, yeah, stay in touch because that's something I think all the feedback we get from young people that we're working with is that they want a different system, something that perhaps is more civil, that is a bit kinder, to use those emotional words as well, that's got a bit more love front and center. Finally, what would you say to that young woman that wants to go into politics, that today, tomorrow, there's an election coming up, she wants to get involved in conservative politics or Lib Dem or SNP or Labour, whatever. What do you say to her to try and encourage her to keep going?
I mean, I have changed something now, probably about 25 laws that have made women and children, or will, when they're properly realised, make women and children safer. And there is no feeling in the world. There is no feeling in the world like that when a minister, I mean, obviously it'd be better to be in government, but when a minister calls you and says, "We're giving in, Jess, you can have it," is one of those moments where you never get credit for it afterwards because it was the government that did it. But those moments are the best feeling in the world when you have worked towards something you really deeply care about and you start to see it coming to fruition. And the only reason those laws exist is not because I'm brilliant in any particular way, is because I am a woman who is exposed to the things that women are exposed to. And I brought that with me to Parliament, and that changed the world. Like that is fundamental. The idea that you cannot change things is literally a lie told by people who already hold all the power and don't want you to take it. You can absolutely change things. Things can and are, or, and everything that ever changed that is good in my life was changed by ordinary people campaigning for it. And the best, I mean, obviously, I can vote. I can't just be voted for, I can vote. I'm pretty grateful to the people who sat around in dusty church halls drinking tea out of broken cups, who sort of plotted the campaigns to make sure that that happened. I'm pretty grateful to them for my liberty. But the best example I can come up with is The Weeknd. Like, if anyone's ever going to come up with a better policy than The Weeknd, I'd like to hear it. That's the best thing that's ever been done, ever. Like with The Weeknd, and don't take it for granted. The Weeknd doesn't exist in China, for example. Like The Weeknd, pretty special, and that was largely invented by people sat in canteens, working in factories, who got together and thought it'd be nice if we didn't have to go to work every single day, and they fought political campaigns alongside political campaigners. And they change the way that every single one of us lives our lives for the better. Like, that is the only encouragement you should need, is that you might be the person who comes up with something that's better than The Weeknd. And you can't just say extend it, because you've got to have a new idea. The Weeknd. Imagine coming up with The Weeknd. That's the reason to enter politics. You could be invent The Weeknd.
Well, on that very optimistic, leisure-oriented note, I'd like to thank our two guests, Hannah Phillips and Jess Phillips, for the discussion this afternoon. We have been recording the discussion, so it will be available as a podcast on the website as well. If anyone listening is interested in our work on youth and democracy or the other events that we have here at Cumberland Lodge, please feel free to follow us on social media. We've been talking about the downside of social media a little bit this afternoon, but it does also have some good sides to it as well. And one is following us at Cumberland Lodge, or you can subscribe to our newsletter on the website as well. But for now, I'd just again like to thank Hannah and Jess for your time this afternoon, and stay safe out there as well.